Yes, and as a technical matter, Ms. Fallon, I can see your icon on the screen, a tile on the screen, which shows your telephone number. And I heard you just fine. So I will watch for that to make sure that you maintain that telephone connection. And I think we'll go forward with your audio, and I think that should work just fine. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. So I will now call the second case on today's oral argument calendar. It's case number A21-473, Tuckborough Farm Homeowners Association, Inc. versus John W. Lang and others. I apologize for the late start. The first case went longer than was scheduled, and that's my responsibility. I apologize for that, but we are now ready, and we will not, of course, compromise the time allocated to this case. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client, and you may begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Bill Hart, and I represent Tuckborough Farm Homeowners Association. This case asks whether a 90-day suit limitation period in the association's covenants bars this action as untimely. And the case comes to the court after a Rule 12 motion and a resulting district court order holding that it does. In asking the court for reversal this morning, I want to focus on two points. First, the standard of review. And then second, the rule under Minnesota law that private periods of limitations are strictly construed against the party invoking them. So I'll start with the Rule 12 standard. Under Minnesota law, when the question is whether an action is time barred, Rule 12 dismissal can be sustained only if it clearly and unequivocally appears from the face of the complaint that the period of limitations has run. That's a very
Mr. Hart,
yes,
to that point, if I may, I just wanted to jump right into the language of paragraph 19 with respect to the 90-day provision that contains a 90-day provision. Would you agree that that paragraph is unambiguous?
Well, we don't allege that it is ambiguous. Under Minnesota law, it needs to be strictly construed against the party invoking it.
Well, the reason why I'm asking is because generally when we look at any type of contract provision, our first step is to determine whether the language is unambiguous. And if the language is unambiguous, then we just look to the plain meaning of that provision.
And we don't claim that it's ambiguous.
Okay, thank you. So turning to, at the very beginning, it says, if construction of or exterior changes to a dwelling or other improvement, so and it makes a distinction between a dwelling or other improvement, and then later on it talks about halfway down, it talks about in that paragraph, fence or other improvement. Would you agree that a fence is a type of improvement under this provision?
A fence can be a type of improvement, but it can also be a part of other improvement, including landscaping costing in excess of $1,000. And so even though, as you know, to sort of circle your question, even though we don't contend that those provisions are ambiguous, if the court finds that there's a conflict between those two things, then it has to strictly construe the agreement or the provision against the party invoking the 90 days.
Well, I understand that. But let's assume for the sake of argument at this stage that it is unambiguous. You would agree, though, that a fence by itself could be an improvement.
And it could be.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. So, and here, what we had was the association approved, I should say, a number of different changes to the landscape. But the one thing it did not approve was the fence, correct?
That's right.
Okay. And so if, okay, thank you. I also, then I want to turn to the language of paragraph 35, and basically the same question. Would you agree that the language in paragraph 35 is unambiguous as well?
Is that the paragraph on fees?
Correct. Yes. That. Yeah. My apologies. That's the attorney fee provision where it says if successful, the party seeking enforcement of the terms shall be entitled to recover from the party violating the terms of the declaration attorney fees. So it's basically the attorney fee provision.
Right. Well, we obviously disagree with the respondent's interpretation of that agreement, but that doesn't mean that because we disagree with it, that it's ambiguous. We simply contend that as unambiguously written, it doesn't apply to a circumstance, this circumstance.
Okay. But so it sounds like for both of those provisions, you're not arguing that you agree that they're unambiguous. It's more the application of those provisions to the particular facts here.
Yes, I think that's right. Subject to what I said before about strictly construing the time limitation against the party invoking it, which if the court finds that as you were discussing that a fence can be landscaping or an improvement, that doesn't support the outcome that the 90-day provision applies to this case, because a fence can also be any other improvement, including landscaping, costing more than $1,000. And if the facts of the case fit into more than one particular item, then it has to be strictly construed against the party invoking the 90-day provision, and the default in that case would be the 6-year statute of limitations that the legislature passed for these kinds of actions.
So I have a separate question, and you raised an issue in your brief, in your appellate brief, regarding the on or about August 14th date.
Yes.
That was in the complaint. Did the association raise that issue before the district court at all? And I did not see that issue being raised in review of the record. If it was, can you point us to where that had been raised before or considered by the district court in its decision?
I didn't see it in the in our legal memorandum in the district court either. It's part of the standard of review, though, that a court is not permitted to take any inferences. When it looks at the face of the complaint, it's not permitted to make any inferences to conclude that an action is time barred. That's what it did in this case. That violates the standard of review. That's one reason why the order can't be sustained.
But that argument that you're raising now on appeal was not if it was not raised before, then that argument is forfeited, isn't it?
Well, I think it's part of the standard of review. So I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. It wasn't specifically raised in that way, and I don't disagree with you on that.
Okay. Because to your credit, you did acknowledge another issue that you raised, that you had acknowledged that it was indeed forfeited, but that we should still address it in the interest of justice.
Yes. And that, appears on the face of the complaint that the association is not the owner of any lot, and therefore the 90-day provision does not apply at all. So yes, that's the other issue, and I did brief that and ask the court to decide it.
Okay, thank you.
So, but our main point is kind of the things that we've been discussing, Judge Reyes, and that is that the 90 days starts to run from the date of completion of any improvement other than a dwelling. The covenants specifically state that landscaping costing in excess of $1,000 is an improvement. The face of the complaint alleges a single large-scale landscaping project. A single set of plans was submitted. One consideration was given by the Architectural Control Committee. for approval. And so the plain language of the covenant, that landscaping in excess of $1,000 is an improvement. The entire landscaping project was an improvement, and the fence sections are merely components of it.
Oh, so I'd like to discuss that a little more with you. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the only thing that was disapproved was were the fence segments. The rest of the landscaping plan was approved, correct?
That's right, but that doesn't make any difference to the outcome of the case, Your Honor, because the provision says within 90 days of completion of the improvement. And because
why don't we look at paragraph 19G together, which I think starts out saying if the construction of or exterior changes to a dwelling or other improvement are commenced without approval. So isn't this a situation where something was commenced without an improvement was commenced without approval, that the fence by itself was commenced without approval?
No, Your Honor, because that very paragraph goes on to say, or other improvement, which is the same, parallels the same language in the other paragraph, are not completed in accordance with approved plans and specifications. And so, you know, the approved plans and specifications did not include a fence. And so the project that the improvement that they were making was not completed. And so that's exactly what it says. It says if the improvement is completed, not in accordance with approved plans and specifications. So they went outside the plans and specifications and completed and didn't complete an improvement at all, as alleged in the complaint. And so that's exactly what the provisions of both the paragraphs we've been discussing say. Landscaping costing in excess of $1,000 is an improvement. And then if it's completed not in accordance with the plans and specifications, then the owner of a lot may commence suit within 90 days. And they didn't complete the project, and that's on the face of the complaint. They didn't complete the improvement.
Well, right, Mr. Hart, I agree with that, but I'm a little confused. I'm a little confused. I want to follow up with Judge Cochran's insightful comment about the language says if construction of or exterior changes to a dwelling or other improvement are commenced without approval. The fence is the only thing that had been commenced without approval. The rest of the project received approval. So by its plain language, doesn't this, the invocation of this provision, isn't it triggered by the fact that the fence had been commenced without approval? So therefore, the language near the bottom of that paragraph that says then the 90 days commences as of the date of completion in the case of any other improvement. So why it seems like, according to the plain language, and that's actually what controls is the fact that the fence is the only thing that had not been approved, and therefore the 90-day clock starts as of the date of completion of the fence, not of the project.
Well, Your Honor, this is the same. I have the same answer as I had to Judge Cochran's question. The paragraph 19G says, or if construction of or exterior changes to a dwelling or other improvement are completed, not in accordance with the plans and specifications. It doesn't say not in accord. Yeah, it does. It says not in accordance with approved plans and specifications. And so, you know, it, to the extent the court wants to look at one time when, the first clause and say, well, you know, that's that could, potentially apply if upon commencement, it still have to look at the second clause and construe this provision strictly against the party seeking to enforce it. And so it does say, or if construction of or exterior changes or other improvement are completed. And then it says, any owner may bring an action within 90 days of completion.
And oh, so then let's look at paragraph 19A. Doesn't that, in this circumstance, the fence was not approved, but the landscaping was approved. And 19A distinguishes between a fence or other improvement, and another type of improvement can be landscaping in excess of $1,000. So why isn't the fencing by itself a separate improvement?
Because the limitation of period provision doesn't say within 90 days of completion of the unimproved or the unapproved portion of the improvement. It doesn't say that.
But it does with the commenced without approval language. Isn't that the same thing?
No.
How is commenced without approval different than unapproved? It seems to be the same thing.
Well, what I'm saying is, Your Honor, that if the first clause can be read to apply to commencement of the improvement, the second clause is broader. And the broader one has to apply because it's strictly construed against the party invoking it. And so, yes, you can find narrower things like fence versus improvement, landscaping costing in excess of $1,000. But this is a private period of limitations. The default in this state is what the legislature has determined is an appropriate time to commence an action. And so, the appellant's arguments are all based on this notion that somehow it's a good thing that, a party can be forced into an earlier commencement of suit only if it's clearly and unequivocally on the face of the complaint barred. Can a Rule 12 motion be granted allowing, on the basis of a claim being untimely? And so, yeah, you can, if you find that there is a provision that could be construed as more narrowly applying and more readily invoking the requirement that suit be brought within 90 days, the court has to reject that in favor of the broader one because of the rule that Minnesota strictly construes these things against the party invoking them. And the reason we do that is because the legislature is the, makes policy decisions. And the courts have determined that unless it's unequivocal, then what the legislature has deemed an appropriate period of limitations is the one that controls. And so, that's why the part about Your Honor, about whether a fence could be landscaping or not, or whether commencement without approval, might fit these facts, that doesn't matter, because this isn't a statute of limitations. This is a 90-day provision in covenants, and so applying the standard of review, it has to be clearly and unequivocally on the face of the complaint barred by the time limitation. And I know that Judge Reyes, you asked about the point about whether the memorandum submitted by trial counsel below specifically talked about on or after. But that's an important point under the standard of review that, and another point going along the exact same line, the district court, again, as I want to go back and remind the court that the Rule 12 standard, I see that my time is up. May I conclude? Those are my main points, and I don't think there's anything more needed for reversal in this case. So I will end where I'll start. This order can't be can't withstand scrutiny under the Rule 12 standard of review or under the requirement that private periods of limitation be strictly construed against the party invoking them. And for that, for those reasons, the court should reverse and remand to the Court of Appeals, or excuse me, of course, to the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. Hart. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument. For those in the virtual gallery, I will, who may have just joined us, I will say that respondent's counsel is appearing solely by telephone with an audio connection because of some technical difficulties. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Christy Phaland. I am here on behalf of the respondents and cross appellants, John and Veronica Lang. The court has made insightful comments as to the language of the covenants that govern the issue at dispute. What I want to highlight here for the court is that these are the association's documents. If the association, as argued in its memorandum, thinks that they are unreasonable or impose burdens on the association, which it finds too burdensome, it has a remedy. It can revise and amend those documents. The remedy is not to seek judicial interpretation to modify the language of the covenants that are clear. It's respondent's position that the court's role here is to apply and interpret the language of the document that the association chooses to the facts of this case and not to rewrite it for them. Now, counsel makes the argument that the 90-day limitation period cannot be applied to this case, and I want to address that. The case law that's cited by appellant in their brief is the Henning case, and it talks about where there's no statute prohibiting the use of a different limitation period, the parties to a contract can shorten the limitation period as long as it is not unreasonable in length. And the 90-day limitation period here is not unreasonable. The court tells us when we look at whether a contractual limitations period is reasonable or not, we have to look at the particular facts presented and the case in question, and that what's acceptable in one case might be objectionable in another. And that's the instruction we get from the court in the Rose Revocable Trust case. Now, when we do that here, and we look at the facts of this case, we find that it's not an unreasonable limitation. This is not the Henning case where an insurance company is trying to enforce a shorter limitation on its insured to its advantage. This was not the Lang's language. This was the association. This is also not the Rose Revocable Trust case where they found that a 180-day limitation was unreasonable because it didn't allow a tolling provision for fraud. The case here shows in the amended complaint that the fence was installed on or about August 14th, 2020. It shows that the association knew and demanded its removal 3 days later on August 17th. It then sends follow-up notices in October again. This is not the Rose case where the association didn't have time to act, or whereas it argues it has to constantly monitor the property to figure out what's going on. The association knew, in this case, what had happened. They knew of the 90-day limitation in their own documents, and in fact, they attempted to comply. They unfortunately missed it by a day.
Counsel, this is Judge Cochran. Can I interrupt for a second?
You can.
So can you explain why the fence sections are not part of the same improvement where they were part of the same initial plan submitted to the Architectural Control Committee? Because if they are part of the same improvement, then I think you would agree that the action was timely commenced.
Correct. And I believe the comments earlier are on point. The fence is an improvement. The landscaping itself can also be an improvement. There can be multiple improvements. And when you look at how the covenants define improvements, you can consider that there might be a plan with a gazebo, there might be a plan with a fence. A plan can have multiple improvements. What I think is also telling in this case is how the association treated the plans that were submitted. Now, the association would like to say that this is all one big improvement. It was submitted as plans and that's it. But if that was the case, then they should have rejected the entire improvement as a single and solitary item. They didn't. They treated this as separate. They treated the fence as a separate improvement that was disapproved. And that gets separate treatment than the rest of the landscaping project that was approved. If it's only one improvement, they should have denied the whole thing and came back and said, try again. But they treated it as separate. Your Honor, when we look at and see that the 90-day limitation period is reasonable, then the next step that we need to do is to say, okay, if the 90 days applies in this action, then what was the improvement? As we discussed, and for the reasons in our brief, we believe that the fence was the improvement itself. With the fence as the improvement, then the question becomes, did the association fail to meet the 90-day deadline? The deadline applies, the fence is the improvement, did they meet the 90 days? And the answer to that question is no, they did not. And the court astutely notes that in the trial court below, there was not an argument about the on or about August 14th. Because the parties proceeded that this was the day. And Your Honor, it's respondent's position that they pled August 14th because they knew it. And appellants will argue that they get every benefit of the doubt on the standard of review and that it should be reviewed in their favor. But they chose to plead a day. They did not plead August of 2020. They did not plead sometime before August 17th, which is when they sent their notice. They pled a specific date, August 14th of 2020. They held to that date in the district court below, which is the reason the district court issued its order, and it should be used on that date should be used on this appeal. Your Honor, I briefly want to address the point of the cross appeal. In addition to the motion to dismiss, respondents and cross appellants have appealed the district court's denial of the request for attorney's fees in this matter. After the motion to dismiss was granted, we requested that attorney's fees be awarded under paragraph 35 of the covenants. And it is a plain language reading of paragraph 35 that gives respondents the right to their attorney's fees following the motion to dismiss. And what paragraph 35 says is, if successfully, the party seeking enforcement of the terms hereof shall be entitled to recover from the party violating the terms of this amended and restated declaration reimbursements for all costs and expenses of litigation. What we have is a term of the covenant, namely a 90-day limitation period. That term was violated as found by the district court's dismissal below. That is all that is required to award attorney's fees. The district court's application of a substantive versus procedural distinction between covenants does not exist in the language of the covenant itself. The district court reasoned that this was a procedural covenant and was not to be independently enforced. But a plain language of section 35 says only a violation of the term of the covenant and the success of the party in enforcing it. The Langs in their defense had to enforce the 90-day term of the covenant.
Ms. Folland, this is Judge Johnson. What is the meaning of the word hereof in that last sentence that you read? Do you see the word hereof?
Yes, I wanted to look briefly. The parties seeking enforcement of the terms hereof. We take that to be of the covenants themselves.
Is that
a larger document?
Is that any different from the phrase that's used in the next clause where it says the terms of this amended and restated declaration?
No, I don't think it's any different. I think both are referring to the same document, which is this larger document, the amended and restated declaration and covenant, which I refer to shortly as the covenants.
I mean, sometimes there's a canon of construction or interpretation that if the drafter uses different language, then it might intend to refer to different things. And so I'm wondering if hereof perhaps refers only to paragraph 35, whereas the next clause, the reference to this amended and restated declaration, refers to the entire document. Any additional comment to that?
Your Honor, only that when we read the language as a plain reading and we see to enforce, and I'm sorry, I flipped the page now. I will say that the hereof refers to the document as a whole and not to paragraph 35. It makes sense as you interpret the document and you read the language of 35. Your Honor,
I have one more question, I guess. So, I'm sorry, yeah. I have one more question. That sentence also says that fees may be recovered from, quote, the party violating the terms of this amended and restated declaration, end quote. So in what way did the association violate the terms of the document?
The term of the document provides that a suit must be commenced within 90 days. The suit below was not commenced within 90 days as found by the district court. So by failing to meet the 90-day requirement and the term of the covenant requiring a 90-day commencement of suit, that's what has been violated by the association.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. If there's no further questions, my timer, and I apologize that I cannot see the court's timer, but my timer says that I am out of time.
Well, our clock says that you have 3 or 4 minutes left. And so so you may.
Wonderful. Then I will.
Counsel,
yes, I would like. Go ahead.
This is Judge Cochran, just following up on Judge Johnson's questions, since you have more time. The last sentence, if we read that in light of the preceding sentence, is it logical to read terms hereof, party seeking enforcement of the terms hereof, to mean the substantive provisions of the covenants? Because the preceding
reasonable.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's fine. I think it's reasonable to read it to mean the terms of the covenant, not the substantive provisions of the covenant. The covenant itself makes no distinction between a substantive and a procedural term. The language says if they're violating the terms hereof. It doesn't say if they violate the substantive terms. Our position is that the district court added language to the document of the covenants that is not contained therein, which is not the role of the court. The court is to read the language that has been selected by the parties, or in this case, the association, into their document, and to use that language as applies to the facts of this case.
Thank you. That answers my question.
Thank you. As we look at the application of the facts, the law here, I think it's important for the court to keep in mind that its role on each of these issues is precisely that, to look at the facts of this case and apply it to the plain language that was written in the covenant. Appellant's brief contains a number of arguments that reach out to hypothetical situations of improvement projects that could have been or things that could have happened here and the way that these would play out. But what we have in front of the court is a very specific set of known facts that are in the amended complaint. And when the court reaches its decision, I would ask that it look only at those facts and apply those facts to the governing documents in the covenant here in reaching its decision. Finally, I want to point out that I do not believe it is proper for the court to address any issues that were not raised below. We did brief this issue, and the court is correct that there's a general rule that a party may not raise an issue for the first time on appeal. There are exceptions to this rule where the interests of justice require. And in the Putz case, as cited by appellants, the interests of justice were served because it was a novel issue dealing with the state's interest in protecting the well-being of children. There is no similar issue here. There's no overarching public concern that would have justice look at issues that were not raised on the first time below. We think it's appropriate for the court to stay only to the arguments that were raised for the district court, as that promotes the preservation of legal resources and judicial economy. If there are other questions of the court, I am happy to take them.
It appears that there are none, and you have only a few seconds remaining, so your argument is well-timed. Thank you very much, Ms. Folland, and we will now turn to appellant's counsel for rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have a few points, but the one that I think is most important is counsel's argument this morning, arguing two things, that the fence is an improvement, and I think I'm quoting here, landscaping can also be an improvement. And if the court views that, those statements, as two viable interpretations of the covenants, then by our argument of strict construction, we do then, in that way, say that the covenants are ambiguous, because if the court views that as a viable alternative reading of the provision in this case, counsel has said landscaping can also be an improvement, and that should be dispositive of this case because of the standard of review and because of the law in Minnesota that private periods of limitation are strictly construed against the party invoking them.
Counsel, if the plan as a whole was a single improvement, why did the Architectural Control Committee approve part of it and not and reject the fencing? And, you know, under the language of the covenants, fencing is listed separately from landscaping. If it had been all part of one improvement, wouldn't the Architectural Control Committee have approved the whole thing or rejected the whole thing, as argued by respondent?
Well, that's one way of looking at that language and trying to apply it to, you know, a situation that occurred. But another way of looking at it is that they approved landscaping, a landscaping plan, a large scale landscaping plan, and that had value in excess of $1,000. And then covenants say that completion of that plan or completion of an improvement not in accordance with that plan, suit can be brought within 90 days of completion. And so, you know, it's just two sides of the same coin. But again, under the standard of review, under the law, the court has to interpret the provision strictly against the party invoking it. And so it's impermissible to do that.
But Mr. Hart, the association approved the rest of the landscaping project. So that seems like the association itself treated the landscaping project as a separate improvement, as an improvement separate and independent from the fencing by not approving that. So it seems to be completely inconsistent to try to now all of a sudden lump them all together when the association never lumped them all together in the first place.
Well, okay. But that's not what the covenants say. How people act and what the covenants say are two different things. And so you're sort of acting like this is...
Right, but we need to apply the covenants to the particular facts and what exactly had been pleaded by the association and look at that record as well. And so your argument seems to be inconsistent between the two. It seems to be, well, we did one thing, but now we want you to apply it in a completely different way.
Well, no, what we did is consistent with what the covenants say. The covenants say if the improvement is completed, not in accordance with plans and specifications, you have 90 days. An owner has 90 days to bring suit. And so the fact that it could also, what the court is saying, I think it could also viably be read to be able to separate off what's been improved from what's approved, but with what's not been approved, that just makes that just proves the point that the strict construction requires the court to adopt the one that applies to allows for the case to go forward under the statute of limitations that the legislature adopted. It's not like this is a performance of a contract and parties are relying on how others act. This is strictly to be applied under what the agreement says as put over the template of both the standard of review and the law that it has to be strictly construed against the party invoking it. So all of those arguments simply prove what the standard of review and that rule require in this case. I see that my time is up, but I'm certainly open for questions.
Mr. Hart, do you wish to say anything about the cross appeal? If so, I'll grant you 30 seconds for that purpose. If so,
well, Your Honor, I agree with the implications of the two questions that you asked, which talks about whether this is a violation. And it talks about whether your questions implied that, and also that the paragraph 35 is a self-contained. That is our argument, that it's a self-contained provision talking about enforcement of covenants that are designed to protect the property, and that is the plain meaning of the. Of paragraph 35, the plain wording of it. And I might add on that point that this is not a document drafted by the association. These are not the association's documents. These are the grantor's documents. And pursuant to those documents, the association was created. So this isn't like we drafted these documents and now we're complaining. This is the council's argument, and now we're complaining about what they say. These are documents that were drafted by someone else, and now they apply to both parties equally. And so, on that point, Your Honor, I agree that paragraph 35 does not permit attorney fees simply because the defendants in this case had a defense to the claim that we brought.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hart. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. And the case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days. And we will now move to the third case on today's oral argument calendar.